Greetings, this is Terry Hooley from Belfast, listening to the Four Idle Hands podcast.
Welcome to the Four Idle Hands podcast. Welcome back, Terry.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. How you all doing?
Yeah, welcome back from Northern Ireland. You've been there for a couple of days this week.
I did. I've been there for about 10 days. As long as I've been there in one bit for a while, actually. So it was quite good fun and a distinct lack of Tato crisps, actually, I'd like to point out. But,
oh, that's a shame.
I had loads of potato bread, but I didn't buy many crisp stocks like this time. So, but, okay. And obviously, one part of it was our. Well, we'll come to it in a minute or two. And I mean,
indeed. Don't jump the gun. So this week, we're going to be running through a little news section, talking about Hall Notes spat. Owen Farrell, he spat the dummy out as well, Terry. We were both at the Say Awards a couple of weeks ago. We haven't spoken about that yet, so we'll have a chat about that. And today's interview is with Stuart Bailey, who has written a very good book about Good Vibrations legend Terry Hooley, record label
impresario
and impresario, and shop owner, amongst other things.
Yes, yeah, that's probably a good way. So,
nothing wrong with being a shop owner.
No, not saying
right,
that.
Terry. Yeah. So, on we go. First surprising thing out of the blocks was a cease and desist order from Daryl Hall to his erstwhile buddy, John Oates.
Yeah.
What do you make of this?
I mean, I can't go for that, that's for sure, like so. But no, I mean, it's a bit bizarre, isn't it? I mean, is this money, you think, or is there someone else to it? Or?
Yeah, well, the info has come out today. And essentially what's happened is the two of them co-own the publishing company that handles all of the songs that they've written over what is probably heading for 50 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there was a third party involved in this to whom they sold 15% of the publishing company some years back. And I think that John Oates had been trying to persuade Daryl Hall to sell and was getting no joy with him. So basically, he went to the third party and said, "You can have my share if you want." And obviously, Hall got wind of this and isn't very happy and has asked the judge to make him stop.
Yeah, I mean, they call it here the ultimate partnership betrayal. I mean, that sounds like a maybe they're just trying to make this up into an Amazon TV show eventually. Maybe that's what it is like. So they want to kind of have a
yeah, it could be. Well, actually, maybe it'll if they've run out of ideas for a song. Then they can use this as grist to the mill, you know.
I mean, they haven't done much. I'm just having a look here. Actually, I think their last record was the Home for Christmas in the early 2006. There we go. Like, I mean, that was a cracker. Obviously, who can't
that says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah, just about it. So every day should be like a holiday. It's a bit sad. I mean, they were kind of, you imagine they would be primed for, like I say, selling on their catalog and be doing a wee greatest hits tour and a 50-year anniversary triple box set of something or other. But, I mean, have you ever seen them?
No, I would have quite liked to see them, but I think the last time they played in Glasgow, it was eye-wateringly expensive. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. So, yeah, I do like some of their 70s and 80s stuff. And, I mean, Daryl Hall's still playing a lot, but it's in the context of this, you know, is it a garage show that he does where he's got guests on every week? He's got Robert Fripp out of King Crimson is on the latest one, as far as I know. So he's been active, and I think John Oates has maybe been twiddling his thumbs a bit more.
Yeah, I'm sure I saw somewhere recently Daryl Hall like solo dates in the UK next year, but I mean probably London, Manchester sort of thing. But I thought it'd be good. He obviously would play some of those songs, but well, maybe not now. But you know, the whole point of it is that the two of them together, but it's like Simon Garfunkel. It's not really. I think the two of them probably are not quite as talented as them, but it's a bit of a shame, actually. But it's going to end up acrimoniously and in court, probably. And
I think the only ones that are going to benefit from this are the lawyers, as usual. So,
maybe what Daryl Hall's aiming for, or maybe John Oates, is they do like a Taylor Swift where he can re record all his back catalog and release it on again copious amounts of triple box set vinyls and cassettes and stuff and t-shirts and things. And,
yeah. Yeah, maybe they're onto something.
They are. Yeah, for sure. But maybe they could take some advice from Owen Farrell, maybe.
Yeah, well, Owen, he's not had a great time, but either he's been distressed by a lot of criticism he's been getting from probably the likes of me and you, Terry, about him not being able to tackle and whatnot. And the England out half has now announced that he's stepping back from
Yeah.
international rugby, which I think probably means that they weren't going to pick him.
Probably. I mean, looking back at the Rugby World Cup, he had a pretty successful Rugby World Cup. I mean, England got to the semi-finals, and you know, he did all right, I think. I mean, his kicking was decent enough, I think. And okay, the few before that, red cards and bad tackles and stuff, but I wouldn't, classify as a decent performance from him. So, and I wouldn't imagine the English rugby fans are a bit like the Rangers football fans or somebody else that would be just abused to him. But I don't know, maybe they are, but it's a bit, I know he
Yeah,
doesn't.
I mean, personally, I haven't seen anybody abusing him online. I mean,
Oh.
people do, quite rightly point out that he hasn't a clue how to tackle, which, if he's talking about his emotional well-being being important, well, then, the physical well-being of his opponents is equally important,
Yeah.
which seems to have passed him by over the years.
That's true. I mean, I'm sorry, not a fan of Owen Farrell since he ruined my 50th birthday celebrations. So we went for 50th birthday. We went down to London for a weekend, and it was the Heineken Cup, and Ulster played Saracens at Twickenham actually. So, and he was playing for Saracens at the time, and I think he must have kicked all the points. I mean, it was something like 40 points to 20 for Saracens, and everything that he didn't miss a kick the whole day. And I've loathed him since then, actually. But no, I think it's a shame. I mean, obviously, but you say maybe he's not going to get picked, and he's only 32. I mean, England have got other players coming through, and they want to build for the next World Cup, I guess. So, but then the potential of his dad coming back in, though. I mean, it's going to happen there as well, but his dad would.
Maybe that's it. Maybe this is phase one of it. That Farrell Jr. will become a coach. Farrell Sr.
Oh.
takes over as England head coach.
No, that's not a bad shout. Has there been any other examples of father-son coaches over the years? I'm sure there probably has been somewhere, mind you. But
I can't think of one offhand, but I dare
no,
say it's
no.
happened.
But I think certainly Andy Farrell will be trying to be locked into the Irish Rugby Union for now, you would think. But maybe there's changes coming there as well. You just don't know sort of down the line for that. But
Yeah, well, we've got Jacques Niebhaber, the Afrikaner
yeah.
coach, has just arrived, doesn't he? So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the Ireland camp as well over the next wee while.
Yeah, so they've got, oh yeah, because obviously I saw last weekend Mr. Sexton was getting a big cheerio from Leinster at the weekend. They played Munster at the Aviva Stadium and Leinster won, but it was close. So he was getting a big cheer from pretty much everybody, probably apart from the Munster fans, mind you. But, so.
Yeah, somebody else who was getting a big cheer recently was Terry Hooley, the founder of Good Vibrations Records. Stuart Bailey, the former NME editor, has written a book about him, 75 Revolutions to celebrate Terry's 75th birthday. It's a great book, well illustrated, and lots of contributions from people in the Northern Ireland music scene and further afield. Here's our interview with him. We are delighted to be joined today by Stuart Bailey, author, journalist, and broadcaster. Stuart, you're very welcome to the Four Idle Hands podcast.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure is all ours. Terry has recently returned from Belfast, where you had the launch night for your new book, which is 75 Revolutions, about the life and times of Terry Hooley. I guess it must be quite difficult, Stuart, a different challenge for you to, write a book about somebody that you've known and been friendly with for such a long time.
It kind of slightly awkward, and you almost have to put your journalist hat on and try and step outside of the friendship now and again and go, okay, I need to ask this question, or we need to sort out this timeline. And I'm fortunate in that I've probably interviewed Terry about 10, 15 times over the years, so I've got this huge archive of transcripts. So there were times when we were maybe less matey that he spoke well. So I was able to pick and, you know, fill it different stories and incidents. But yeah, and you know, Terry, for people who aren't aware of him, he's an extraordinary human being who's against all medical odds is about to reach his 75th birthday. And you know, Manchester had Tony Wilson, who guided Factory Records, and you know, people like Jeff Travis at Rough Trade in London, and to a lesser extent, people like Malcolm McLaren, who kind of, you know, through all the madness at punk rock, Terry was the guy who helped to guide a generation of us in Belfast. So lesser known to an extent, but very much a public figure in Northern Ireland. And the film Good Vibrations was well received everywhere. And that grew into a stage musical, which was bonkers. And then the musical went pre-pandemic into a bigger venue, the Opera House. And then it became a bit jazz hands, a bit overdone, I think. And then they took it to New York, and I think they reined it back in and made it a little bit more credible and a bit more meaningful. But Terry is very bemused by his, you know, people were suddenly famous during punk, and then they were forgotten about. And then if they were lucky, they were remembered. And Terry has become this celebrated figure who took a stand against sectarian conflict.
Yeah.
And he laughs about it. And his punchline is, so, you know, the next step is Good Vibrations on Ice, you know, the ultimate feel good spectacle, you know. And I wouldn't put money on it not happening, you know.
I mean, you could just see if young Fergal Sharkey pirouetting around the SSE Arena on ice.
Yeah, to get in the double axis, it's going to happen, yeah.
I mean, obviously, you've had a long relationship with Terry Hooley, and one thing I was just thinking when I watched the launch event at the OES Centre was, he's not hard to interview, because he doesn't require a jump start. He just kind of goes, and he's got a fantastic chat. But to get to the stuff you want to talk about, you may have to go a long detour, I kind of thought.
He has the blarney. He loves talking. He just takes huge relish in talking, but he doesn't always get you from A to B in a direct line. He'll go around in this beautiful circuit, and obviously for someone who's trying to get to the nub of the story, saying, "Look, where are we, Terry? Can you give me the punchline, please?" It takes a little bit of patience and a little bit of threading, you know, five or six interviews and going, right, that's that part of the story, here's this part. And that you know, that there's a fun that goes with that. And every now and again, you find that this one story is actually three stories that happened over separate years, maybe separate decades. And yeah, in his mind, he's put them in this beautiful fabric of a narrative. So, interesting and slightly challenging, but I don't think there was ever a dull period of his life. And Terry is celebrated as the guy who put out Teenage Kicks by the Undertones, and his first record was Big Time by Rudy, which is arguably as exciting. And then he just started hurling records out because he realized it was relatively cheap, and he had an audience that would purchase him and give him a bit of cash flow. And you know, I was part of that generation. I was born in 1961. So I was sort of 16-ish when punk was happening. And the idea that your mates at school were getting records out on Good Vibrations Records was massively exciting. I can't understate how thrilling that was. And Terry's whole rhetoric was all about, well, everybody can do this. Everybody's potentially a creative person, and everyone's potentially a star. So that was the kind of thing that I kept coming back to, you know. Yeah. That was my baseline. And no matter how bizarre the stories were, you eventually, with a wee bit of stitching, you could get them to make sense.
Get involved in it, but how did you become aware of Terry and the Good Vibrations, the punk stuff, obviously, but how did you get into that? Sort of, was it just something that was, because I was an OMA, and to be honest, there wasn't much in those days. You didn't have social media, which would have been great, but my first kind of introduction to Good Vibrations was in Coleraine, oddly places. We went to the record shop in Coleraine, and that the band The Extremists were playing or
yes.
in there, signing copies of their. I'm just looking at the list here. Got five, it was. And then we're like, oh, and we'd heard Teenage Kicks, obviously, but didn't really, the record label didn't figure out what was going on. And then it opened up after that, you know. So,
well, I was East Belfast. Parents not keen for you to go out at night. Obviously, there was horrific stuff happening all across the north, and Saturday afternoon was very special to every teenager, because you could go into town, you could get a bus home before it got too dark and too intense, and you could hang around like Corn Market, you know, which is just a circular space that everybody would hang and chat. But then the two record shops, Caroline Music on Ann Street, which Kyle Leach was the main guy there, and they were really the first people to pick up on punk, really. And you know, would have been where you would had gone to find out about Rudy and when the next gig was and stuff. And then you would go round to Terry's place. There was three or four other shops there that I mentioned in the book, but Terry was late picking up on punk. Was a guy called Gordy Owen who kind of hung around the shop and eventually said, Terry, you have to go and see Rudy at the Pound. And, you know, I think it was January, February 78. Terry went down and he had his epiphany. But I, you know, like a lot of people, you would do that Saturday afternoon, the two record shops in Corn Market. Terry wasn't always there. It was a while before I worked out who Terry was, because it was other people working in the shop, and sometimes Terry would come in late with a hangover, you know. But then after a while, you realize that he was this, you know, he was somehow connected to this amazing energy source that was going through popular music, but Northern Ireland, you know, punk was. Proof of concept of punk really was what happened in the north, you know, that you know, politics and attrition and self-realization and all the things that musical form did was helped along by Terry. And so by 78 I kind of knew who he was, and I was going to the Heart Bar, and I mentioned at the book launch he would get up on stage at some case during the night with a few pints in him and make the speech. Was it like Henry the Fourth, you know, into the bridge? And he would tell us all that we were capable of great things and shout and roar. And then after a while you realize that this speech, you know, you heard it 10 times. So you were kind of groaning after a while, going, oh no, he's going to make the speech. But the first couple of times you heard it was genuinely inspiring, because, you know, here was an adult telling you that you could have an alternative viewpoint, and you could live your life through alternative means.
Yeah.
And that was very radical. And you know, again, Terry didn't just, you know, appear out of nothing. Terry had been part of Vietnam protests and stuff from the age of 15, yeah. And was heavily involved in CND. And so he had been at the coalface for more than 10 years before punk arrived. So he had the kind of the radical toolkit, you know, that understood, and then the sense of mischief that was part of that 60s generation. So he threw all that together, and his own sense of anarchism, which is sort of very unique. So we were caught up in this in fantastic vortex.
Just thinking about Belfast at that time. I mean, I lived in Omagh, which was, you know, a fairly placid kind of place. And we certainly would never have got permission to go to the Heart Bar or the Pound. There was zero chance of that. But I mean, I guess having the background of the Troubles, did that like enhance the punk? Because that was it was, you know, obviously edgy and whatever it was, but rebellious. But I mean, did that make it even more relevant than, say, it would be in London, where they were just, you know.
I think your fun was a bit more precious. It was harder to find, maybe. And also that you had kind of been repressed, you know, the Miami Show Band killings were 1975. So basically, you know, we can assume now that there was state collusion in the murder of a series of musicians on the side of the road between Banbridge and Newry, you know, which is just obscene when you think about it. So that was that certainly caused a lot of touring bands, international touring bands, not to go to Northern Ireland. And obviously there was other things happening around that time as well. Just, you know, incendiary devices and car bombs and horrible random sectarian killings. So, when punk found, first of all, it was people going to Bangor, to the Trident and places like that. And then later the Heart Bar. And the Heart Bar was, in the films, it's always this absurd place with chicken wire and bollards and security cameras. But that's what it was. And it was in a quite a frightening, badly lit part of town, just on the edge of the security barriers. And there had been people killed there in 1975. You know, people had run in with guns and machine gunned them. And, my understanding was it was the official IRA drank downstairs. So it was the stickies were drinking downstairs. And then the publican was flying in strippers at the weekend. So I think you're waiting for your punk gig on a Saturday night and the strippers were coming down the stairs. I know loads of slightly shifty looking men. So it was a proper dive bar. And with that kind of music, that was perfect in a sense, and they hear, I'd say about 60% of the people in the Heart Bar were underage drinkers. That was constantly annoyed, the people who ran it, but they semi-tolerated it. But yeah, that was your people. And possibly in segregated Belfast, the first time you were meeting people from the other side of town. So that was also very illuminating. And you're curious.
Yeah.
You're going, who are you? And, you've got this name that doesn't fit with my social construct. But you've got an Iggy Pop badge, or you're here at a Rudy gig. So, I think an important part of the peace process was happening in places like that. And Good Vibrations went out on the road and they called in an Irish cheer. I think they did five dates or something like that. But, even the fact that they had dared to stick a load of punks in a van and take them round was quite exciting.
Well, they played at OMA, and I can remember getting a ticket. I remember us getting a lift into town. So we went to town in our normal gear. We got dropped off in the car park or the bus park. As soon as my mum and dad or whoever dropped me off, then we got turned into, put some safety pins in, all the rest.
Yeah.
And then ran up the high street, over into the town hall, and boom, there we go.
Yeah. There was always that sense of how much do you want your parents to know, And the uniform around that time would have been the long hair, the American college jumper, with the V on it and the stripes across it. And the parallel trousers and the Oxford boots or the Doc Martin boots. And it was that corner boy, like the kind of undertones kind of adopted that, with shorter hair. But anybody in Belfast who was walking out with drainpipe trousers or short hair, you're automatically a suspect, who's like, you're not one of us. So all of that thing, and like you say, it could have been you sneaked out a little skinny tie, to wear at the gig or whatever, or your badges suddenly appeared, you'd at school wearing badges underneath your collar and stuff, and then you'd flip your collar up and people would see how cool you were. And then the original core punks thought you were a poser. There was that whole idea of you're a weekend punk, you're not a full-time punk. But glorious stuff. And I was in a band from 1979. I was in various bands, none of which were that good. And I'm not being coy, though. They just weren't very good. The first one was called Acme Music. And we were we loved The Clash and we loved Protex. Protex would have been, two or three of the guys from Protex were at my school. So the fact that they had gotten a deal with Polydor Records after putting out a Good Vibe single, we went, well, we're next, So you would be badgering Terry, going, we've made this demo, Terry, and he would sort of get a little bit glazed, going, oh, this is the 40th demo I've had this week, and he never really did much, and we were outraged. We're going, Terry, this is your job to make us punk rock stars, and it was like, no, this isn't the cross I opted to carry. So he, at that stage, he was already abdicating, I think, really. And by 1992, Good Vibrations
was bust. Terrible paperwork, terrible cash flow. You know, though, if a band did well, he would buy somebody a guitar or he'd buy them a PA system. There was never any paperwork or accounting, which was very Terry. You know, it was sort of almost like this, the people's capitalism. You know, if people do well, they'll help you, but don't expect a royalty statement.
And there's a couple of contributions in the book from people who've known him a long time as well, Stuart, which maybe allude to that element. So you've got Brona Gallagher, Dave Hyman, and Brian Young, amongst others. But, I mean, it is quite clear from Brian Young's interview that there was absolutely no long-term strategy for Good Vibrations whatsoever. And, you know, he is one of those people who's a bit of a paradox, Terry, in that, he opened record shops, he opened a record label, and yet professed to hate the music business.
Yeah. And there were, you know, when you think what the Beatles were trying to do with Apple Records and stuff, you know, there were precedents in the 60s of how do you do this and how do you not make money? And I think, you know, one of the great paradoxes was the Clash and the Sex Pistols being signed to major record labels. And, you know, the Clash, Complete Control, is a brilliant song by the Clash, but it's all about how naughty old CBS put a record out without our permission, you know, and they got a near right lather about it. But you dine with the devil, and that's what you expect. And not long after Terry was going, I think Crass were coming up with this whole idea of punk as a complete lifestyle, where you could grow your own food and you wouldn't, you know, eat meat or wear leather. And so lots of people were sort of arriving at the same time on theories. How do we manage this feeling of freedom? And in Terry's case, it was freedom from accounting, you know, and freedom from business. And in the film, the part of the tension is David Hindman, who runs the print workshop upstairs, and David's an anarchist, but he gets things done. Terry's on the middle floor, and then the Whole Foods shop, Sassafras, is on the ground floor.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, in David's interview, he's going, you know, Terry couldn't get out of bed in the morning, so we had to knock him up and make him his breakfast and all this. And Terry thinks it's really funny. He's going, well, that's kind of, you know, that's the alternative lifestyle. I was out all night partying, you know, you can't expect me to be up at 10 a.m. So he was a volatile human being. And I think Factory Records became a kind of an alternative business, and it was very good in the 80s. But, you know, 80s were a decade of irony and postmodernism and beautifully designed sleeves, and Factory Records, you know, led the way. And I think Good Vibrations wasn't really equipped for that job. So once it had hurled, you know, a few good bands into the ether, it kind of crumbled. And Terry, I think emotionally, financially, I think the pressure really got to him. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people who stand against the consensus, it kind of burns them out. And yeah. And I do remember meeting Terry around that time, and he was kind of broken, you know. And then he famously, he's got a prosthetic eye. He lost his eye as a child in an accident with a bow and arrow. And then his other eye, he started to lose his sight in it around 1982. So one of the doctors says, well, you will go blind. And at this stage, everything's going wrong for him, and his personal life's a mess. He thinks he's going blind, and he spends 6 months of his life listening to Marvin Gaye. Let's go, and what's going on? You know, so, you know, there are very extreme ups and downs in his life. And, you know, what I wrote isn't a definitive book. There's about 40,000 words there. And the idea was to let the pictures carry a lot of it, but there's enough there to give you a kind of a crash course in Terry Hooley.
I love the picture. Yeah. I'm looking through it. Only go, Michael, fantastic.
The what, sir?
I just love the pictures. I've been looking through it all again. It's fantastic. So
yeah, it's beautifully illustrated with stuff from, I guess it's maybe Terry's archive, Stuart, is it?
There was, you know, he was a little bit cautious. I think he's also a little bit cautious about putting his head above the parapet. I think he likes almost not being that famous. And then reluctantly over the last 10 years, he's become more famous than he ever was. But every time he gets a little spark of acclaim, the haters come out. So, you know, there's a cottage industry of backbiters and haters and people who say that the narrative is wrong and that, you know, Caroline Music and Kyle Leach and various other people should get more credit, Davy Sims and, you know, the DJ. And, you know, there were a lot of other people, but, you know, that's why it was interesting to have Greg Cowan and from the Outcasts and Brian Young chatting. I'm trying to remember, what was the thread of that conversation?
Well, it was actually about the Terry's archive side of it.
Yes. So he was a little bit reluctant to go. He'd gone, God, are we doing another book? And then he kind of went, yeah, we'll do another book. But I think I didn't let him see the whole book before it was published, but I let him see the stuff about his parents and stuff because I thought I don't want to get that wrong. And he's been ill quite a bit, but getting close to my deadline to get the book out, and it was all written in a 6-month, you know, flurry, which is how I tend to roll. Very close to the deadline, he says, let's go up into the attic. And we went up into Hooley's attic. And it was this treasure trove, you know, pristine copies of the Good Vibrations singles and pictures and, you know, contracts with Seymour Stein and all sorts of stuff. And it's not organized, you know, it's all over the place. There's just boxes and boxes of it. But I couldn't stop smiling because I thought, well, if Terry lets me use a dozen of these pictures, the book is home in a boat. You know, it literally will... make What's an Okay Book into a really nice book, and that was a beautiful thing, really. You know, suddenly you've got pictures of Terry Hooley when he's 15 protesting outside the City Hall about against the war in Vietnam, and pictures of him when he's working in the Kodak affiliate company, which is around the time there was a death attempt on him. And so you're able to show the growth of a human being through a couple of very fierce decades, and almost I think that carries as much weight as words, you know, because you can just see the development of this human being.
How's your Good Vibrations record collection, Stuart? Do you have a lot of it or some, most of it? I'm saying
I would argue this is a source of banter between me and Terry, and I go, Terry, you put out some terrible old mints near the end, you know, and it was you know, he would go, oh well, I fancied so and so's girlfriend, you know, and I thought well, I'll put the record out then, you know. So there was always this randomness about it, and Good Vibes International and if you were saying where does post-punk kind of occur in Terry's catalogue, you would say our acts like Big Self and stuff would have been where Belfast was trying to work something out different. So I'm not a completist. I've got a bunch of the early ones, and, you know, my copy of Teenage Kicks is in a cabinet in the OEM Music Centre, signed by all the Undertones.
I saw that. That was a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, and my copy.
Really tempted to smash that, by the way.
my copy of Big Time by Rudy, which is like a proper dinner plate. It's the worst press record you've ever seen. But so a lot of my stuff, and a lot of the posters in the cabinets at the OEM Music Centre are stuff that were originally on my wall as a teenager. Rudy posters and Outcast posters. So, you know, I'm a terrible hoarder, and there was stuff in my own attic when we were doing the exhibition. I was going, this is my punk archive here, you know. So it's all gone on. So yeah, I don't think it's a perfect label, and there are collectors in Japan who want to own every Good Vibes release and associated Good Vibes release, and then they get on to kind of bands that went on parallel to that, like the Peasants and stuff, and they're ringing me up, going, or messaging me and going, you know, if you can get me that Peasants record, you know, I'll pay a grand, you know. And you're like, it was good, but it's not that good. But in my travels as a music journalist, you're in Los Angeles in a bar, and somebody starts talking about
protects or the undertones or, you know, Stiff Little Fingers. And you suddenly realize this fleeting moment, which was a couple of years really, actually it resonated around the world, which is incredible.
Absolutely. It's funny because, like, we called our podcast Four Idle Hands after an artist that was on the record label. And oddly, I didn't realize that they made Four Idle Hands had made a 12-inch single. And I found that in a shop here in Omaha a couple of years ago. And so I bought it for £1, I think it was. But
yeah, was that 99 Straits or was that?
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, it was like it was a four track one, I think. So
okay. Yeah. I think near the end, people appropriated the name, you know. Some good acts like Fat Lady Sings, Nick Kelly was going, can I put out a record on Good Vibrations? But basically Terry allowed them to use the name, but he didn't pay for the pressing or distribution or anything, you know. So there, you know, even when I did the discography, I think I stopped after the first 20 records. I was going, those are the real ones.
What's your favorite one, Derek? What would be your favorite of all that? I'm just looking at the list there, actually.
Well, I think I you know, obviously Rudy and the Undertones, but Protex, Don't Ring Me Up. You know, that was 16, 17 year old boys who, you know, really didn't know what to do musically. And you can feel the kind of nervousness in the record where they're singing. But also there's just this incredible energy about it. And it's kind of a bit punk rock and a bit Buddy Holly. There's these little yodels in it. And then the Chuck Berry, Johnny Thunders guitar solo. And I adored it. I just thought that was just what a moment. And there was a whole 50s thing in Belfast punk, you know, those hand claps on every record and stuff and little woo-woos and in the choruses. And so it was kind of classic in a sense, you know. Teenage Kicks is a girl band record. It's like Shangri-La's and Crystals and stuff. But some of the Belfast punk was very conservative. In Manchester, they and Sheffield and Glasgow, they were saying, "Well, we can really go radical here," and we didn't have quite. I think by that stage, U2 had kind of sussed out what they could do with that post-punk guitar sound and stuff.
Wow.
And there was a changing of the guard around 1981, 82, where all the energy and not all the energy, but much of the energy and the creativity went south. And
curiously, Stuart, the only time I saw Rudy was supporting U2 in Dublin just before Christmas in 1982, just before war came out.
Wow, okay. And was that what was the venue for that?
The St. Francis Xavier Hall, also known as the SFX, now closed, sadly.
Was that, I think the Mekons were at that as well. I could be wrong. I think the Public Image were meant to turn up and there was a whole kerfuffle. What I recall, and again, I could be wrong, is that Paul Morley covered it for the NME and he came back raving about U2. And it was just, you could just see the tide changing, you know, and Bono's a big, you know, he's a fan of Good Vibes and, you know, that they took a lot from that. But I think in terms of where music was going, they were canny. I think, you know, they went, oh, this sound and this idea and this feeling allied to their own, you know, strange community Lipton Village thing was,
yeah.
So yeah, but I think, and then Belfast went into the doldrums for quite a while.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was a bit of a change in the guard, as you say. Moving on to some of your other work, Stuart, you pointed out you've written some other books, including The Ballad of a Thin Man, which is an authorised biography of Phil Lynott and Thin Lizzy. Is that's a very different challenge, I guess, is it, to what, well, once again you're trying to get the tone right, but I think Lizzie's kind of famously factional, is it, in terms of versions of events?
Yes. I realized around 83, 84 that I my slim musical talents weren't going to get me very far. And a lot of there was a sort of an exodus around that time. People were just going, I'm out of here. So a lot of my friends had gone to North London and I kind of followed. And then start. I literally, it was Dick Whittington. I brought a typewriter over with me, like a little Boots travel typewriter, and started sending reviews. And then got, you know, I worked at Record Mirror and then the NME, and I had a really great time. And along the road, then I got an audit. I'd written about Thin Lizzy a few times, and you know, when the CDs were reissued and stuff, I was like, oh, this is, you know, some of the stuff's great. And I would have had it. I saw the Live and Dangerous Tour 78 at the Ulster Hall. And then I knew management, because it was a whole, as Thin Lizzy fell apart, the Pogues were rising, and a lot of the crew and the management and everybody went on to look after the Pogues, which I spent quite a lot of time with the Pogues. And so then I got a call from Lizzy's ex-management or current management, said, we've got a book deal, would you like to write a book? And I was going, yeah, okay. And it was about three or four different camps who all loathe and despise each other. so I had to do the Kissinger, kind of get my diplomatic kind of hat on and try and I got most of the people, but Philomena Lennett was she was writing her own book at the time, so she kind of excused herself, but I got most of them. And you know, I really enjoyed writing about early Thin Lizzy, the Eric Bell era, and then it got a bit you know, it got messy after that, and certainly Scott Gorham was really helpful. I spent a lot of time with him, and Brian Robertson was, yeah, shouting and roaring, but helpful. And then at the end, you gotta go, oh, there's these awful records at the end that you kind of got to say something about. And they didn't censor me too much. I probably self-censored myself a bit. Every now and again, somebody would tell you a story and go, I can't really put that in the book. That's too grim, you know. So you know, you're writing an authorized biography, you are a little bit in hock to the you know, to the people that are paying you to do the book. And that was the first time I thought, Do you write about people that you care about? Because it could ruin your appreciation of what they're about. But it was interesting. And then I made my peace with Philomena, and I think I did something for radio or something. And she says, "Oh well, come and meet me." And she was along the coast. Was it Howth or Sutton? I can't quite remember. Yeah. And I met her at the house, and then she says, come on, we'll go and see Philip. And she took me to the graveyard. Oh. And we tidied up his gravestone together, and she was kind of chiding him as she tidied it up and slapping the gravestone, going, it wasn't a stone, it was like a slab lying on the spot. You weren't allowed vertical gravestones in that, mm-hmm. that graveyard. But she was going, oh, you stupid boy. And then we did the interview in the Philip room, where she had all the memorabilia around and his jukebox and everything. And so, bless her, that was a memorable day.
Yeah, and the whole Lizzy story is one, you know, just fills you with exasperation. It's somebody who is incredibly talented, that, you know, what happened to him would never have happened to anybody that talented these days, would it? I mean, there was no protection for him whatsoever from his record company or his management. He was just allowed to go into a tailspin.
Well, yes, and you know, these days a lot of our acts, they make a record every 2 years, you know, and then they tour it, and then if they have sensitive people around them, they'll say, right, well, you're going to take a little bit of time off to rest and recuperate. But you know, That era, mid-70s, you know, Rod Stewart and the Faces and Bowie and Thin Lizzy and all those bands, they were expected a record out every 9 months. And you listen back, or you look at those records, and obviously a CD gives you the timings of them, and some of them are like 40 minutes, 36-minute albums, you know, and maybe two cover versions on it. So they just had to whack it out and go back out there. And, you know, there's a business logic behind that, where you've got people excited and you have to keep doing it. But incredibly bad thing to happen to a bunch of individuals, and you know, and Lizzy had no pastoral care really to speak of, and you know, I think he was a tough guy anyway. So when he started to take heroin and cocaine and all the rest of it, there was a sort of an entourage who kind of tolerated it. And I think a few people like Frank Murray, his tour manager, left. And he said, "No, I can't do this anymore, Philip. You know, you're gonna, you're killing yourself. You're killing your talent." But I think those are rare instances. So that was depressing, having to write that. You know, having to plot that out. And you know, when I was at the NME, around 94, 93, 94, 95, there was, you know, Kurt Cobain, you know, died. And again, you're kind of going, was there nobody there to really help him? And Richie from the Manic Street Preachers and PJ Harvey had a really terrible breakdown. And you just think, what an industry. Are you not looking after your talent properly? Is there no regime that will help these people and sustain their careers and sustain their mental health? So I'm kind of quite long out of the music industry, and I don't know, are there any protocols? Are there any, you know, people with vision that are seeing that? I don't know. I got a feeling that they're still putting them on the catwalk and cranking them up and letting them go.
Yeah, well, that may be the case, but I mean, there are some high-profile examples of people just stopping touring in the middle of a tour, like Lewis Capaldi and Twilight Sad, another Scottish act, where you know they seem to decide themselves that this is what they need to do. You may be right; it may not be their management that's saying it. But on a slightly more optimistic tone, we've had a couple of crack and reissues from the Lizzie Back catalogue, Stuart. I don't know if you've seen the recent reissue of Vagabonds. There's a Universal done a cracking job of a 4LP box set, and we've had the Live and Dangerous box set as well. It does look like either Universal decide there's money in it for them, or they're kind of reassessing some of the back catalogue.
I think there's I think there's a lovely fashion at the minute for boutique releases, where they will go, right, there's 1,000 people in the world will buy this. Same with the Horselips, you know, reissues, that you can put it all together quite nicely, and that there are people there that want to hear 7 live versions of Cowboy Song, you know, and you're kind of going, well, yeah, why not, you know? or you can hear songs in transition, you know, from the stage before they get into the studio, and you know that there are various versions of Boys Are Back in Town, where you can almost see it. It's not quite there yet, but the magic will arrive. So I think that's great. You know, I wouldn't discourage that. And Vagabonds, you know, when you get to the Eric Bell era, first album's a bit wonky. Second album's very thinly produced, and Vagabonds is where Eric Bell and everyone kind of went, well, you know, we're not going to defer to the engineers and the people in the studio. It's our sound and it's our band. And you listen to Little Girl in Bloom and stuff, and you go, those are beautiful songs.
Yeah. You know, and there's also, you know, the start of the twin guitar sound in there as well.
Yeah.
And it's got that classic kind of early Lynott lyricism to the lyrics. It's something perhaps when the tough guy image came in, he kind of put that in the back burner a bit, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely. The vulnerability, I think, is really endearing. You know, you could tell, you know, both Eric, well, Eric Bell was adopted, so he had a whole strange thing going on. And then Philip was, I think, originally sent home to Dublin, where they pretended they had adopted him. So these two characters, two thirds of Thin Lizzy, were kind of insecure about who they were and who their parents were. And, you know, and I, you know, Philip was in a band called Orphanage when Eric Bell first saw him. And even the name of the band, I think, really resonated with Philip. And then Shades of a Blue Orphanage was the name of Orphanage. And also Eric was in a band called Shades of Blue. So it all kind of meshed together. And I think that little private world that they had then was kind of lost when they got into the four piece Fantastic Four Thin Lizzy era, which was exciting in a different way. But I think it's good that people know are more aware now of that earlier period.
Do you think there's any any kind of keenness to do some sort of Good Vibrations reissue at some point, or that just be left?
I think there's been a few now. Cherry Red had put out a thing a couple of years ago with Shell Shock Rock, the DVD, and it was, but there was a lot of kind of very bad power pop kind of thrown in there. And I think there was a really lovely big time Rudy compilation on Cherry Red and a few other things, but Terry never kept any paperwork. Even some of the bands are disputing. I think a lot of them, you know, to Terry's dismay, are sort of going, well, we paid for the recording session and we own the masters and we can do what we want. And I think he quietly thinks that's been a bit disloyal.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can understand they want to get their music out into the world. What do we do? I'm trying to think of how, certainly half a dozen of my friends and associates have tried to sit Terry down and go, come on, why don't you just try and generate a bit of paperwork, try and assert your ownership or your part ownership of this, and then put something really nice out. And he just rolls his eyes and he's not interested. He gets bored. And he, the anniversaries come and go, and you kind of go, you know, 45 years of Teenage Kicks, or before that was 40 years, and he won't do it. And that's kind of what makes him quite charming.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think that there's a weird value to the label, and because of that, because it is properly anarchic.
Yeah, I think the film's a great record of it as well. It's funny, a friend of mine up here up in Scotland runs a film club in Afford, which is a very small community in northeast of Scotland. And Saturday night, they had a film night, and he was struggling for a film to show. So I lent him my Blu-ray of Good Vibrations, and apparently he said they were rocking in the aisles. And said, no one knew what it was about. They didn't really know Terry Hooley, because it's a long way from Belfast, but they all knew, obviously, Teenage Kicks. And so it just was a massive success. He said it was fantastic. So,
It is kind of every man. It is the little guy that won't go along with the nasty regime, you know. That translates to any part of the world, and that's what makes it perfect in a sense, you know. And he's never really sullied he went bust, but he didn't mess up people's careers. Technically, he didn't owe a lot of money to artists and stuff. So, I sometimes think acts and labels and projects should have a finite life, you know, and do it, keep it perfect, and then get on with another part of your creative life, you know. So, so bless Terry Hooley. It's an amazing legacy, and the biggest part of that, I think the music's part of that, but it's almost a personal example of how you can work outside of the system and still create thrilling, empowering moments.
Sure.
Yeah. So, and sorry, Terry. I attended a talk that Terry did for the BBC when the Good Vibrations movie was coming out at the Edinburgh Festival, and they got a big marquee set up. And it's like a revolving door of interviews and acts. So the time, allocation is absolutely strict. And of course, Terry went off on one. So the interview more or less ended up outside on the lawn because everybody had to get out for the next act.
I've had the best conversations I've had with Terry are normally about 3 o'clock in the morning. Or 4 o'clock in the morning, and there, absolute illumination. You think that is the most incredible thing I've ever heard. That sentence or that idea, and then you wake up in the morning, you can't remember it. You know, and I think that's how he operates. And I think he had a similar thing with Phil Lynott. You know, around the time of Black Rose, he met him, and they partied all night. And he says Philip told him the greatest stories ever. And told him how to live his life, and he woke up in the morning, it was all a blank. So So, you know, sometimes you can't document it. It was one time 3 o'clock in the morning. We'd been DJing at Voodoo, and we decided to go up Cypress Avenue, you know, in Van Morrison. We brought a crowd with us. So we all went strolling along Cypress Avenue at 3 in the morning, and it was summer, and it was the most perfect thing ever. So, you know, those are the moments I'll treasure, really.
Actually, the book is fantastic. I mean, just where can people go and find the book? Where's the best place to get it, Stuart?
Well, on Bandcamp, it's Stuart Bailey. We're on eBay. My kind of website stroke magazine is Dig With It, so digwithit.com. And I have three of my own books now. So there's Trouble Songs, which is the history of music and conflict, which I put out in 2018, and it's still selling. It's just this incredible thing. And then I did one called 75 Van Songs, which is me writing about my favorite Van Morrison songs with a, and that was a sort of a lockdown project that I didn't try to be the definitive thing about Van. It was just me being lighthearted and loving the songs. So you can buy them all on Bandcamp and eBay and stuff. But
Highly recommended to the next
I'm
anybody.
kind of proud
Yeah,
and
great.
certainly the lesson that Good Vibrations gave me is that you don't need to ask people's permission to do stuff. And self-publishing, you know, for Trouble Songs, I sold 4,000 books from the kitchen table. And when I was sort of touting the idea of it and showing sample chapters, publishing houses were talking to me like they would be doing me a favor, putting it out, you know. And then you would say, "Well, what about payment?" And they're going, "Oh, right. Oh, well, I don't know." So, I think that, to grab your own destiny and do your own thing and be your own agent is very tiring and very messy, but incredibly satisfying.
Yeah, it's a great read, Stuart, and it really catches the voice of Terry, albeit somewhat edited. Otherwise, it would be a very long book indeed. But there's some great anecdotes about disagreements with Bob Dylan and John Lennon that I'm not going to spoil for anybody. Just go out and buy it. It's a really good stocking filler for at this time of the year. Just before you go, Stuart, could we ask you your thoughts on the state of modern music journalism, and particularly a couple of things: journalists not getting paid for the work, and secondly, maybe the state of the NME, which seems to have turned into smash hits.
Well, I was at the NME, possibly. I think I started 1988, so you could have said the glory days were over. The Tony Parsons, Julie Burchills, Nick Kents, Charles Shar-Murrays, Roy Carrs, all the people had this almost free rein to write these long form, imaginative, personal stories, and the audience was there was 300,000 people buying the paper every week. But when I was there, it was still quite exciting that the Stuart McConeys and Andrew Collins and Danny Kellys and Stephen Wells and all sorts of people. And we literally said, we announced Britpop, to the world for better or worse. We just went, here's two bands that hate each other. Let's do a cover like a boxing match and see what happens. And it worked. We provoked a generational thing. But also Acid House and Criminal Justice Act and all sorts of amazing things that went through the and a weekly, you're constantly arguing, shouting, knocking things together, a great team of people. And as I was leaving, came back to Belfast, and then Radiohead started to just put out their own records and use the internet to publicize them. And all of a sudden you realize, well, the media is losing so much of its rationale, and sales went down, and Melody Maker crashed, NME stopped putting it out as a publication. And I would still look at things like The Quietus or there are places, I would still have a look at Hot Press, and some of my favorite Irish writers are accessible, and even Niall or Nine, where you could find out about local music and stuff. So there are places we can find it, but it's just hard to find good definitive voices to tell you whether a record's good or not. And obviously, all these things are subjective, but there were people who I would respect. And if they said something was good, you would literally go down to the shop and buy it, unheard. So I do grieve a little bit. Me and my daughter put out a magazine called Dig with It, which was about arts in Northern Ireland. And, you know, we would talk to like Frank Ormsby, the poet, and, you know, painters. And part of the thing was, you're not going to write, you know, a lot of reviews now start like, you know, the underachievers, the indie three piece jazz funk combo from Larn. And you kind of go, well, that's not writing. That's word salad. You know, that's a train timetable, you know, and I really resent that. And, you know, and I've done a few journalism workshops recently, and I'm going, can you not read Lester Bangs, or can you not read Grail Marcus, or, you know, this woman's work was a really brilliant compilation of females writing about music, and Kim Gordon was involved. And, you know, there you can set your sights higher. And you know, there are people talking out loud saying, you know, public music writing is about to have a vinyl moment where it will become cool again. And I would be delighted about that, but I don't know if it's going to happen. I don't know. Certainly putting out the magazine, we had a core of people who loved it, but, you know, a lot of people were quite indifferent.
A lot of folks today don't read anything very much at all about anything.
Yeah, but you fight on. You know, whatever's left in me, you know, is just about doing things that I like and championing things that I love. And, you know, my take on Terry Hooley is like, you know, the last couple of chapters of Johnny Cash, where he meets up with Rick Rubin, and he has this swan song at the end of his life, and to his dying breath, he's trying to articulate stuff and trying to resonate. Yeah. And, you know, and I think on a good day, that's what Terry does as well. And I think that's the example that we should follow, you know, just never give up and just keep bashing on.
Sounds good, Stuart. Well, thank you very much for your time today. It's been fantastic. I really enjoyed Thursday night. Go and look at the book, buy the book, have a read, share it with, you know, and so on. But thank you very much for your time. It's been fun.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thank you.
Bye.
He's a very...
Well, Terry, what can you say? Stuart, a very nice man indeed, and fascinating to hear his insight on not just the legend that is Terry Hooley, but also Thin Lizzy and... The Enemy, his former paper.
No, nice bloke, and say fantastic book. I picked up my copy Thursday night. I got an invite to the book launch, and went along to that. And so the great and the good of sort of Belfast. It's quite an interesting mix of people actually at the book launch, because if anyone's in Belfast and wants to do a bit of a musical history of Northern Ireland, certainly it's called the Oh Yeah Centre. It's right in the middle of the Cathedral District, around the corner from the Heart Bar, which if you've seen the film Good Vibrations is kind of well represented. Unfortunately, the Heart Bar as it is today has been, what's the word, gentrified compared to how it was before, I think. But it's a lovely venue, lots of memorabilia. I think Stuart alludes to it in the interview. He's got his signed copy of Teenage Kicks is in one of the cabinets there. They've got stuff from Gary Moore, Van Morrison, The Outcasts, Snow Patrol, Ash. They've got gold discs and silver discs and stuff and everything. So, and they've got, you remember, I don't know if you saw the pictures of the Elvis that points up to the Good Vibrations record shop. Obviously, the original one is long since gone, but they've got the one that was used in the film as you go in. So it's quite a cool little kind of history sort of thing. And it's a nice venue. They've got a bar and a cafe. And I said the Undertones play there at the weekend. I think there's a few other bands play there on a regular basis. And the book launch was good fun, actually. They had like a Q&A with Terry. Actually, Q&A is probably wrong. It's probably just A from Terry, I think.
A monologue.
Yeah, because I think he is. Clearly, it would be hard to, that kind of comes across, certainly, any documents or any interviews you've ever seen, he's certainly never short of a chat. I talked to him beforehand, and he was very, very chatty. He would talk away and answer your questions, very polite. And he actually doesn't look much different, apart from his sort of darker hair. He still looks the same with that strange eye, kind of looks at you sort of thing. So very interesting. And then at the end, of course, they couldn't stop him. He got up and sang a couple of songs. He had sang spoken words. He had a guitarist there. He was from Van Morrison's band. I'm sure someone's gonna ask me who he was, and I'll Google it and find out. But that interesting guy, good. I mean, he's got the history of Belfast punk in his pocket, I think. So, and the book is well worth a buy, and you can get it from Stuart's, like you said, his Bandcamp page, I think. So,
yeah,
certainly
good.
Enjoyed it. Also, I mean, I had a look around the room. The only sort of other local celeb I met was Taylor from a band called Brand New Friend, who does a show on Radio Ulster. And funny enough, Brand New Friend, they're supporting Ash at the Ulster Hall in December. So if anyone happens to be in Belfast and wants a gig, buy a ticket for that, because they're great and Ash are fantastic. So it's really good.
Yeah.
And Terry didn't remember me in the shop, by the way. That was disappointing.
Yeah, that's devastating, isn't it?
Yeah.
he must only have had about 20,000 customers, you know, apart from you.
I mean, for me, Stuart again mentions that he says about his archive and his loft of photographs and vinyl records. I'd love to see that collection of stuff he's got up here, because, I mean, I've got a few of the early Good Vibrations ones up to number Outcast, was that number 10? But it kind of drips off after that. The quality goes down, but he's got apparently mint copies of loads of them upstairs. Like, so, because they printed about, I had a look, they did about 3,500 of each one at a time. It's quite a lot.
Yeah.
I thought, but they've obviously all sold over the years.
Yeah, but yeah, those were probably only about 50p a pop at the time, Terry. Were they? Would that be what you
would have paid for? Yeah, back 50. Yeah, it does sound about right, actually, possibly even less. But you don't see many. I had a quick look in a second-hand record shop in Belfast, not this time home, the time before, and they didn't have any lying around or anything. So I kind of think people have already bought them. And I'm sure he mentions, you know, collectors in Japan will collect these things and stuff. But so, no, excellent. And we get a chance to either buy the book or listen to some of the Good Vibrations tunes. They're well worth checking it out. Thanks.
Yeah. And another calls for schmoozing was the Scottish Album of the Year Awards. And we were both there, Terry, at the Albert Halls in Stirling, which is also a very nice venue. What was your thoughts on the evening and the awards?
I quite enjoyed it. I mean, I did feel a bit celebrity-like going to that. I've never been to that sort of event before. We got a goodie bag, which was, you know, quite nice. A little Say Awards goodie bag and stuff like that, and from a little record cleaner from that Seabass vinyl stuff. But it was an interesting event. I mean, it was a fairly standard sort of format for these things. They went through the awards. Interesting enough, it was Vic Galloway that did the sort of hosting. And on Thursday night at the Terry Hooley event, I chatted to a guy who'd been to the Northern Ireland equivalent, which was also hosted by Vic Galloway, funny enough. So he seems a bit of a niche from him. Oh, well, I just remember, actually, I did meet Stephen McCauley. He also does a great show on Radio Ulster last week. Sorry, I forgot about him. But I enjoyed it. I mean, they had a couple of live performances. Dead Pony played, who I thought were great. They did, what, three tracks, Michael? They were decent, weren't they?
Yeah, I really enjoyed Dead Pony. I hadn't heard of them prior to the awards night, but they definitely had a bit of oomph about them, didn't they? Good sounding three-piece, kind of pop metal kind of setup. Yeah. And a girl with a lot of sass, and say, yeah.
Who's the guy? I forgot the guy's name now. The jazz guy that played first, who won it last year.
Fergus McCready.
Yeah, I felt a bit sorry for him, because he came on and he had his back to the audience a bit, the way they had his piano set up. And, you know, it wasn't his playing was fantastic. And he was standing beside us at the end, I was chatting to him. But I did feel a bit like people were just chatting over him a little bit at the start, but.
Yeah, and the other sort of main musical contribution for the night was the celebration, kind of Hall of Fame job for Paolo Nutini's These Streets album. So Paolo wins the award, you know, doesn't turn up for it, obviously. And then they had a house band with a couple of singers. Was it Grizzly Bear? Was he the
guy? He was pretty good, actually. Yeah, he was good, actually.
Yeah. I quite enjoyed him, but I just didn't really get it. You know, there are more consequential Scottish albums over the years than that one. You can't even get it on vinyl, Terry. So,
right.
You know, it's not like it's a record that's readily accessible in every format going. So, I mean, I thought they made a good fist of the songs that they covered, but they are just covers at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, I thought that was good. Like a guy, Grizzly Bear, had a fantastic. I mean, I made a little video with his son. I spoke to him. I grabbed him outside for a photograph on my way out, but so he was good. And there was quite a few. I mean, it's a bit of a shame they didn't get more of the award nominees up to play. I mean, Joseph Kay was there. He was actually standing behind us at one point. And the guy from Mogwai, Stuart Braithwaite, he was standing again at the door when we left, just sort of standing there, they'd be upstairs maybe. But it's a bit of a shame they hadn't. And like I say, I think if Palantini had turned up, that would have given a bit more credibility to it, but the fact they didn't. And again, tough, I guess, at the end, because Young Fathers won the award for artists or year. And clearly only one of them was there, the guy Aloysius, who I did speak to at the bar. He's a big guy, by the way, but again, they only had one of them because they were playing a gig somewhere the next night, I think, so not practical to play, obviously, but a bit of a shame. But...
Yeah, and also, I mean, my other observation is that, you know, while this is not like a kind of, you know, breakthrough performers award, the Scottish Album of the Year, you know, Young Fathers have won it before, and there are other bands who probably could have benefited from the exposure a bit more than them. I mean, you know, they've just gone from, you know, a couple of weeks ago playing two nights at the Usher Hall and played in Glasgow and played, you know, some other dates around the place. So, you know, it's debatable whether they needed that accolade, good and all, an album as it is, and much as I liked it, you know?
Yeah, no, I thought, you know, the Hamish Hawk album was very good. And funny, Stuart was down in Glasgow, Edinburgh this weekend past, and saw Hamish Hawk do an acoustic set somewhere, I don't know where it was, and said he was absolutely amazing. I thought he would have been available to come and think these people to play a bit of a, but then maybe they wouldn't want to be favouring one over the other sort of thing. But I just thought, like you say, someone fairly high level to win that award, and you know, was it 20 grand they get? He didn't need the money, I suppose, but anyway, that's what it is, I guess. So, but I enjoyed the evening. I mean,
yeah, it was a good evening, yeah.
And, you know, hopefully, but again, and then this is obviously fairly obvious, it was very, in Central Belt centric, obviously, being in Stirling, you know, Central Belt, Glasgow, Edinburgh, but that's just how it is, I guess. Those music scenes just dominate Scottish music. I mean, they could easily have held that in Aberdeen in the music hall and had a couple of local bands playing to get a bit of, you know, even PR with all the folk that do turn up for these things, but I doubt
they... It's too far from Edinburgh, Glasgow.
They might make it to Dundee, maybe, or the Caird Hall or something, but... Yeah,
that's a possibility, I would say. Yeah. Good. Well, roll that day on. Hopefully it might even happen next year. So that's about it for this episode, Terry. We will be back this side of Christmas, I think, possibly.
I think so. Got another one planning, so it should be good. Look forward to that. And quickly, how was Black Friday Record Store Day for anybody who was...
Yeah, Black Friday was okay. I mean, the list of releases was long-ish and, you know, reissue-centric, I would say, rather than, you know, vital new music. There were a couple of the releases, so, well, the Olivia Rodrigo Guts four-track EP, which was, you know, basically songs that didn't make it onto the album, was very popular. We had somebody queuing from 12:15, and we weren't open till 10 o'clock, so... Yeah, kudos to her. So, yes, that was popular. The U2 reissue of Under Blood Red Sky on red vinyl was also popular. And there was a BBC album by The Faces, and that sold well. Unspectacular, I would say, in most respects, Terry. But people got what they wanted. That's the main thing.
I always check on eBay just I'd forgotten, actually, on Saturday night I was in my mum's house and I was checking on eBay, and I guess I had messaged you about the De La Soul 7-inch was going for a fair bit of money, like, so probably double and upwards, which I thought was quite interesting. But maybe that was quite limited, I don't know, but... so there'd be a lot of sellers in America selling that one for £190 or something at one point. But
ooh, right, that's quite long, yeah.
I guess people will always try to make a profit on some of the stuff, which is a bit disappointing. But
sadly, this is the case, yeah.
Indeed.
So. Okay, Terry, let's leave it there, and we will be back before you know it. So till the next time.
See you soon.